am Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast.
Where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see below the surface.
That's right. So in our series of murder mysteries that occur on the coast of the UK, we're going to talk about Broadchurch. This is episode number 103. We're going to talk about Broadchurch, which is a British television series mystery, a murder mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I picked this one because I watched it and I was completely blown away by it.
It was good.
It was really something. And then I talked to you about it and you had already seen it. So I thought that was great. Let's talk about it. Because it is 8 hours long. But I came... Yeah, well, okay. Eight episodes.
Oh, okay. I thought it was 6 episodes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I came to it through the American series called,
Grace Point.
Yes. Which don't watch it.
I did not watch Grace Point. In fact, I didn't even know about Grace Point until you mentioned it.
Okay.
But yeah, in typical American fashion... They felt like, hey, this show is so good, it ought to have an American version.
Well, you know what? There's also a French version I saw.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. It's
well, French I could understand because, well, it's a different language. But,
language, yeah, culture.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I've lamented in the past, well, why did they have an American English version of Harry Potter? You know?
Oh, yeah.
It's just like, you know, God forbid that we should learn something about a culture that's not ours. But even though the whole book was set in England, it seems like a missed opportunity. They didn't change much, as I understand. But
well, I saw somebody complaining on Amazon about that series I was telling you about called Rivers of London, where the American editions of those books had some of the slang cleaned up so that Americans would get it. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
And then they said, but the audio is from the British. And I went, oh, okay. Good. So, you know.
Wow.
And I did notice a few things they changed. And I'm like, why did they change this? There's no reason.
Yeah, I just don't get it.
Grace Point was the same way. First of all, it had David Tennant in it. And he was playing the same role he played in Broadchurch, except they were making him talk with an American accent, which he was good. But, you know, that's why. And then it was all really whiny and a lot of emotion. And so we stopped after 2. We just couldn't take it anymore. Okay. And that's when we said, well, let's watch Broadchurch. And imagine our surprise when we saw the first episode was practically line for line, but it just felt quicker, sharper. We said, wow, something, whether it's the direction or whatever, is making a huge difference.
Yeah, yeah.
It was definitely superior.
Right. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. You know, I probably won't watch that other one. But like you mentioned, David Tennant is one of the stars of the show. He plays Alec Hardy, who's a investigator. I guess you'd call him a D.I. Mm-hmm. D.I. Hardy.
Yep.
And then Olivia Colman, who just blew me away.
She was great.
I could
great.
Not get enough of her. I mean, oh, man. She plays Ellie Miller. And you know, I clicked through to see who she was, and she's been in some movies that I've seen.
Oh.
But I don't recall seeing her before. So, I mean, she was in Hot Fuzz, for heaven's sakes.
Oh.
So I got to, really? Yeah, I got to watch that again and find out where she is.
Okay.
Because I found her irresistible.
She was very good.
Yeah.
And especially, like I say, since I was comparing the two, I kept going, see, she's doing this job and she's not crying all the time and whining about how she didn't get the promotion. She mentioned it a few times, but it wasn't this
continual. She was mad. Thing. She was not in tears. She was just angry.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Which is, yeah, I thought she was just perfect. It was, I totally, the reason that this thing captured me when I was finished with it, again, it was 8 episodes long. When I got to the end of that, I felt that was like a novel. It kind of hit me in the same way as a book often does. And most of the time, TV doesn't do that. It's different, you know?
Right.
But here, it felt like a novel for television. 8 hours long. And I was trying to think of what else has hit me that way. And One thing that came to mind was Stephen King did a miniseries one time called Storm of the Century.
Mm-hmm.
And
I never saw it.
I felt like that was a novel for TV. That was one of the few things that he wrote just directly for TV. It didn't come from anything, and it's one of his best on-screen times.
Hmm.
But it's called Storm of the Century, and I think it may be 6 hours long.
Okay.
I'm not positive, but it was a miniseries on American TV. But I was moved by it. The whole thing takes place at the very beginning of the show. David Tennant has come in from out of town, and he has taken a job that Olivia Colman's character, Ellie Miller, that she expected. She was on vacation, and she returned at the beginning of the show to find that this job that she was promised was taken by this person from out of town. And so they're partners. He's in charge, and she's a detective sergeant. I think she was D.S. Miller, and he was D.I. Hardy, right?
Yeah, she worked for him. He was her boss.
Right. So he's a detective inspector, and she was a detective sergeant. But what happens is they find a body on the beach of this town called Broadchurch. And it's of a young boy, something on the order of 12, 13, maybe. 14. Yeah, something like that. And now they've got a crime to solve. They realize pretty quickly that it was murder. And more, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, and more than that is the fact that the town is so small that Ellie's son was good friends with this little boy. And right. The families were, I say little boy, but... Yeah. They were both the same age, and the families are really good friends. So she's feeling this on a very personal level that she's having a hard time separating from, since she's never handled a murder before.
Yeah, and this is what the show is about. I mean, there's a murder mystery here, but what it really is about is the people in this town, their reaction to this event, and it goes very deep, I felt. The characters they were all great. I didn't feel like there was a weak link in the whole thing. All the actors were excellent. The characters were deep. They all seemed real. I mean, it didn't seem like, remember when we were talking about Calvary, we got to a point where it felt as if there was a little bit too much. And I forgot what you kind of called Calvary. It was a morality play, I think you said.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like that was going on here. I felt like they were all like real people, really reacting to these events.
Yeah.
Did you feel the same?
Even the unlikable people, the people who you mistrust, because as it goes along, of course, you're being directed here and there and you're thinking, oh, did so-and-so do it? Did so-and-so do it? And even the unlikable people, like the lady who lived in the trailer, the old guy who ran the newsstand, you find out more about them and you see they are three-dimensional. You feel for them. You're sorry for them. Even if you don't really like them, their circumstances are such that you can kind of go, oh, I start to see why you are the way you are.
Yeah. There were no saints in this either.
Mm-mm.
That's what made it real. Partly anyway, there was no, stellar people. Even Ellie Miller had these faults that, I would love to talk about.
Well, we will.
Oh, yeah. So I wanted to make sure that I asked you this. When I read like a mystery, or in this case, watch this, which again felt like a book to me, is the mystery the thing for you? Or is it the reason that I ask is because the mystery wasn't the thing for me in this show. It was everybody. It was watching this small town disintegrate. The mystery in this case was very interesting, but often I find that in a mystery novel, the mystery isn't always the most interesting thing to me. It's what else is going on.
I agree. Okay. I am always thinking about who did the murder or whatever it is in a crime novel or on TV or a movie. But if it's not interesting through the characters, then I don't want to read it, or if I can guess it too soon, because I'm not very good usually. So, in fact, I was super proud that two episodes before the end, I figured it out.
Okay, cool. But, that's what I was wondering. And it's interesting that you say that.
Did you?
No, I had it. It was, I was at the last episode, but okay. it was not too far in that I figured it out. It was, you almost, suddenly went, oh, I was, man. Like, oh geez. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like,
so,
what?
So, well, yeah. But so I do urge people to watch the show without knowing who the murderer is, but we're going to talk about that in a second. But yeah. To me, it's not vital. It's like, if you know who the murderer is, it doesn't mean that this is not worth watching. And I,
oh no.
Yeah.
No. Because one of the things that impressed my husband and me was we were watching and we kept saying, they're not just glossing over things. They're delving deep into people's lives. And that's what made it compelling. Yeah. And we would get done with something and we would start talking about the characters. Both of us would be washing dishes or something and we'd bring things up and motivations and stuff. And that's what makes me not really like locked room mysteries very much. Because that tends to be more about the mechanics and the timetable and where was this placed and that placed. It's not as much about the people.
Too many
and
vows.
I just don't care. I like to try to guess who did something. And, you know, Agatha Christie can still keep me guessing, even if I've read a book several times. If it's been long enough, she misdirects me all the time. But it's because I care about the people or the detective or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I felt that way about this one. I've seen it twice. 8 hours, two times.
Wow.
Yeah, I actually did rewatch it this week.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Very impressed. So it held up well on rewatching then. That's
well,
good.
It did, except. I don't know if we want to talk about, we should probably wait for spoiler. Wait. Yeah, let's wait for spoiler. But is there anything else you'd like to talk about before we go over there?
No, except to say for anybody who's listening who hasn't tried this, which I doubt as many people. I think most people just wait when they see our stuff, but because they know we'll talk about spoilers. But I would say that one of the things I think that makes this different, though I didn't put my finger on it at the time, I found this through Wikipedia, is that the meticulous care that the writer put into doing all the plotting and the way he focused the story on families, on the people in the town, was really deliberate. And the fact that they shot it like a documentary in order, because even the people in the show didn't know who did it.
Yeah.
Until the episode, basically, where it was revealed and they were going to shoot it. So they're kind of all living through it. And because they didn't know, that they had to shoot it in order. They couldn't reveal it. And they insisted on, like, almost always they used the first take, so things were rough and kind of real.
That's
and I
nice.
Think all that, yeah, all that kind of went together to make it a really immediate feeling, fresh.
Yeah.
And not in an edgy way, but just in a very, I guess, real is the only word I can use. That's, I think that's why you were saying it felt like a novel, because you get all those little details that you don't usually get in a TV show.
Right, right. Lots of dwelling moments where you feel stuff that you don't have time to feel when it's moving at, you know, light speed.
Yeah, it was really well conceived.
Yeah, and you also mentioned that you had read, I think it was in Wikipedia, that he had planned it. I say he is the author, who is Chris Chibnall.
Yeah.
You said that he conceived it as a trilogy, but made the first one complete because he was afraid that it would never be picked up. So there was a lot of care. But I would love to say that there is a series two, and I've seen the first episode of series two, and I'm really happy to say that it is not a repeat. There is not a dead boy at the bottom of the cliff at the beginning of season two, which tells you that it really is about these characters. They're not looking to do another series with the same thing again. It's a genuine continuation that was conceived of before they did season one. So I think that's really worth saying. In fact, I found a quote somewhere where he said, you know, were kind of moving out of the murder mystery territory and things. And I was like, wow, how interesting is that?
Yeah.
So.
But I liked it because when we got done watching the whole season, we went and started looking up stuff about it. And that's when, you know, season two was getting ready to start pretty soon. And we were kind of worried about the same thing. How many big murders can, sensational murders exactly. can happen in a yeah. small place? And because we had just finished watching it and were so invested in the way the characters were revealed and the way the dynamics of everybody in the community, without it being a soap opera type situation, that we said, oh, he's going to look at the town now as it goes forward. And we went, now that's interesting because this guy surprises thing, yeah. you, but in very real ways. So
I thought the same thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, how many shows have we seen where I don't know if it's the executives or whoever saying, you know, well, they really liked the last one. We ought to do that again. You know, right? 24 is a huge example. You know, 24 mm-hmm. was pretty cool that first season. But yeah. somewhere during the second season, it was just like, you know, I feel completely manipulated now. It's just the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
You get to some point where, you know, it's just unbelievable that this guy is going through all that. And I say this as a Star Trek fan.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have more tolerance for some of that.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, you understand what I'm saying. It's just, oh, yeah. There just comes a point at which it becomes nothing but stuff happening. And manipulation and trying to just pull emotion out of you or just action.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, this has not crossed that line. Mm-hmm. I haven't felt that way at all. And I didn't feel that way in season two, episode one.
Yeah, I've heard season two is really good. And I guess it's finished in Great Britain. And they got picked up for season three. So
yeah, cool. So I should mention, I saw Broadchurch on Netflix. It's available for streaming on Netflix. And season two is airing right now on BBC America. And I think they've aired the first two episodes.
Okay.
And it's available. I think it filters into iTunes or something like that.
Okay.
But I don't know that it's available for streaming anywhere unless you pay $2 an episode maybe or something like that.
No, that's why we're waiting.
Yeah, we saw it on Netflix watch, also. BBC America was yeah. where it's playing now. But it has completed in Britain.
Yeah.
And it airs on a network called ITV, which I guess is a commercial network in Great Britain.
Oh, okay.
I learned that. I thought maybe ITV was like Irish or something, but on Wikipedia it says that ITV is a commercial TV network in the United Kingdom. Independent television.
Which is rare. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So cool.
Okay.
All right. So into spoiler territory a little bit.
Okay,
yeah. So before we get into some of the kind of thematic things I wanted to talk about, I wanted to mention, you know, you said that the actors didn't know who did it. And I saw that as well. I watched a little, you know, making of thing on YouTube.
Oh.
And they were all talking about, boy, we have no idea who did it. And we think it's a good thing. You know, especially the inspectors, Tennant and, Ellie and Hardy. Mm-hmm. Ellie Miller and Hardy.
Yeah.
They said, oh, it made it so much better for us because we could suspect everybody. And, you know, but remember when I said I keep comparing it to Calvary. It's like they're both on the ocean right. and blah, blah, blah. But when I watched Calvary again, there were moments in there that I could see that the killer had reactions that made sense in that context.
Oh, right, right, right.
When I watched Broadchurch again, there was none of that. I didn't feel anything from that guy who did it. I didn't see anything other than every now and then there would be like a lingering shot or something like that. There was like two of them because I was really watching for it. I was really just watching this guy the whole time and thinking, you know, boy, did he do anything where he displays some guilt? And then, then when you said that you saw it, was it two episodes before or right before two episodes or something like that?
And yeah, there were two episodes left when I suddenly was like, Well, let's see. How does this usually work? Usually, it's the person you suspect the least. And then I went,
uh-huh.
It must be Joe. Because yeah. He would match the description of some description that I'd seen, like the plumber's assistant. And
so, yeah. So that's super well done. But the reason that I kind of think, aha, is because they handed out the three final scripts.
Okay.
On the same weekend to everybody who had to know.
Got it.
So the last three episodes, he knew it was him.
Okay.
So that's just why it was interesting that you caught it kind of right around that time. So I thought that was interesting. But I can't think of a moment. I didn't think the way you did. You know, it had to been the least, you know, it was just, I was really completely unknown. And then at the very beginning of the last episode, I just went, oh my gosh. That's it.
I've read and watched too many mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, I suddenly pull myself out usually and start going, who have we seen early on and who has not really been looked at very much?
Yeah.
Let me think about that person.
Wow. And I tell you what, when that happened, it was brilliant because Ellie Miller having to deal with that.
I thought her reaction when she's like, oh, no, I won't do anything. Just let me talk to him. And then she just unloads on him and is kicking him and hitting him and screaming. And I was like, I feel like that's real.
Yeah.
I feel like that's exactly how somebody would act who is so betrayed. And the thing that I loved at that moment was she suddenly is on the other side of the spot where she'd been judging people from.
Exactly right. She had been questioning somebody. Yeah, she had been questioning somebody who had some stuff in her past.
And that her husband had done.
That her husband had done to kids that were in the house.
Right.
And she said, how could you not have known? Just disgusted, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And now here she is with a murderer in her house, and she had no idea. And then the moment when Beth told her, oh, man, when Beth said, how did you not know?
I thought she was going to come out and be sympathetic. But
yeah, I was thinking that, too. But to have her do that, well, oh, my gosh.
It's what everybody, because you don't want to think that you would not know.
Right.
And you know what? Liars are good at lying.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to mistrust. How can you go around mistrusting the person you're married to?
Yeah.
Unless there's a problem in your marriage somewhere, you're not going to look for that. That's how people get away with stuff.
Yeah, and at the very end, in the you know, after the climax and stuff, you know, Tennant was telling her, "You never know somebody's heart."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that works. You know, that's a positive and a negative both. You know, when we have somebody to forgive, we never know what's in their heart. You know, you know, they talk about that in the church. You know, how can someone who is horrible, you know, at the end of their life, repent and have God react to that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't know what's in their heart. That's why it's frowned upon to run around pointing at people and
to judge people. Yeah, yeah, that's, you know, judge not lest you be judged. Mm-hmm. Ellie is the perfect example of that, because a lot of times people will take that and say, well, you shouldn't say they're doing anything right or wrong. And that's not it.
Right.
We can look at people and say, this thing they did is wrong. This thing they did is right. We should, you know, help correct them, or we should applaud them for something good. But you can't go around thinking you know why people did stuff. Because the other thing I liked about not knowing what's in people's hearts, the thing that really also struck me as true is when they kept going, how could you do this? Why did you – how can you say you loved a 12-year-old boy?
Yeah.
And he'd go, I don't know. It just happened. I don't understand it. And we're used to TV telling us in books, here's why this person thinks this way. In fact, we're used to doctors and scientists telling us as if we're machines. Well, this nut and bolt got loose.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so you're not thinking properly and you need these chemicals. Well, sometimes the human heart just doesn't know. It just is there.
Yeah.
And it's what we do with it. Like, he should have resisted and he didn't.
Right.
It didn't matter why he felt that way. What's the right thing to do? And that's what you have to struggle with.
Exactly.
On small and big things.
Right, right. Yeah, and if you look at the town as a whole, I mean, you know, when you look at that, there was one moment it was episode 6, and I wrote this down because the vicar was saying, the second commandment tells us, love your neighbor as yourself. and you're like, well, that's not the second commandment. But, yeah. But anyway, it is a good thing. That made me laugh because there's these things going on throughout here. But anyway, I don't want to get off of what I was going to say. But the love your neighbor as yourself, I mean, it is a good point. And that's what he was trying. He was scolding the town because they all jumped all over this guy out of fear or judgment. Jack, because of something that happened in his past that people just leapt to judgment and they didn't really understand what the full situation was.
Mm-hmm.
But they leapt to the fact, well, he had to have been guilty. And they hounded him until he, he killed himself, which is still, that was his decision to do that. But he was, that was a horrible moment. And the thing is, I've lived in a small town and I've seen things like that happen, not to that extent, I've seen people shoved away for reasons that people don't understand.
Well, and really, when the vicar's doing that, and I can't remember, since I haven't rewatched it. But one of the things I was thinking is, you knew this was a dangerous situation. You turned your back on him. You should have spent the night with him. You should have had him come to stay with you. You should have done more.
Yeah, he probably should have done that. But the vicar, in his defense, did go to the police and said, this guy is in trouble and you need to go protect him.
But I feel like the vicar, and maybe this will show up in season two, I felt like the vicar made several choices which showed his, perhaps, shall we say, inexperience.
Sure, yeah.
Because there's one, and I do find it interesting that he was such a key character, and thank goodness they didn't do what they did in the American one, where he was like, in the American one, the vicar's going, oh, I still haven't gotten over that torch I had for you, Ellie, or no, Beth.
Oh, no.
Remember when we dated?
Oh, jeez.
Right? See what I'm saying here? So luckily, I was so relieved that strand wasn't there. But he did things like when the grandmother goes to him and of the boy who was killed, goes to him and says, you need to step up. We need you in the community. What he does is I'm like, well, that's one way of handling it. He goes to TV. All right, everybody, come on, let's all get together and to let our grief out and blah, 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 and do whatever it is. When what he should have been doing is also a lot of person to person, and he wasn't. Right.
And it's really interesting that he's really – this is kind of a God or a religion-less community, right?
Yeah, these people, which I think is very I think that's true of Britain.
Yeah, they're not all going to church every week.
Yeah.
It's just that when this event happened, he started to see them.
Right.
And I think that that's an important point. So he was young. He was inexperienced.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he even experienced some hubris or pride when he made that first, love your neighbor as yourself speech.
Yeah.
And it was so well received as, you're this, pillar of the community now. I think I felt that in his face where he was like, hey, I'm the man right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, but he did get to tell D.I. Hardy that, they need me. And even if there was some hubris in there, it was true what he was saying.
Oh, yeah.
Is that, they're looking for something. And there was a moment with Beth. Now, Beth is the mother of the boy that got killed, right?
Yeah.
And she clearly was not a religious person.
Right.
But this happened, and she keeps brushing up against it because she's got this psychic guy telling her. so all of this stuff, she's got a boy who passed away. She's talking to the vicar who she saw at the grocery store, and for some reason she just told him that she was pregnant, and which was a secret at that point, that she was struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that she unloads on because she must have seen him as a safe place, and to see him as a safe place must have made her think further. But there's this moment where she goes to meet the mother of another kid who got killed.
That's right.
And during that meeting, that other lady, her life had fallen apart. And she described like what she did during the day and stuff. And it was basically drinking, right?
Yeah.
And she said, I wrote this down. She said, Beth asked her, what do you do? And she, and this lady said, I worked for a little bit, but I got these terrible headaches. I couldn't concentrate. And also that nagging sense of pointlessness. What does it matter if I don't finish this work? The worst has already happened. So she is completely in despair still, however long it's been since her child died. And Beth is looking at her now, probably as an example of how not to do it. Right? But
or tell her that she'll fall into that.
Exactly.
Yes.
But it was like, you know, God was nowhere in this conversation. I mean,
you'd think that would be something, even if all you're doing is screaming at him,
right?
Mad, but, because you want someone to blame.
Yeah, and but that's interesting. I felt, because it is kind of, who was it? Hugh Laurie. I saw a quote by him one time. Hugh Laurie is the guy who played House, and somebody asked him if or what he felt the biggest difference was between Britain and the United States, and he said the United States is a very religious country. Right. And we're sitting here saying, man, it seems like, you know, a lot of people are not very religious in this country.
Well, I don't think so.
Yeah. So in England, it must be a lot different.
Now, compared to England, we're super religious.
Yeah. So
because even if a lot of people don't go to church, they still believe in God or a higher power. And I think a lot of the British, from what I've read, and please correct us, anybody who's listening, don't.
Yeah.
And it's not just that they don't go to church. They just don't believe. Whereas, you know, this is a big country. And as they say, the whole middle of the country, they pretty much believe.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. But that nagging sense of pointlessness that she talked about.
Well,
I was just going to make the point that I think that people get that in day-to-day life too. It's not like you have to have your child, you know what I'm saying? You don't have to get your child murdered or something like that to have the sense of pointlessness. I think people often find their way to despair without something higher.
Yeah.
It's like, this guy, Ravi Zacharias, said something like, there's a sense of wonder that you have, right? And as a baby, you know, if you walk up to a door, then that's a sense of wonder, right? But then as you get a little older, you have to open the door for you to have that sense.
Uh-huh.
And then you, as you get older, you have to walk into the door for you to have that sense of wonder. But ultimately, only God is big enough to fill it. You know, as you continue to get older and get more experienced or less impressed with everything, right?
Yeah.
But there comes a point, I think, in a person's life where you just, you know, think, well, this is really pointless. But I think that religious people generally don't have that.
Well, or if you have it, it gives you someone to talk to while you're working through it. I mean, part of this made me think of the book of Job. And here's Job, everything awful's happened, and his friends are coming up to him, and they're being very reasonable about everything. I'm trying to think where I heard this. I think it was Peter Kraft talking about making sense of suffering in an audiobook that I'm listening to called Socrates in the City, which is a series of talks that had been recorded and really great. Listen to it. It's on Audible. Anyway, and he was saying he never could understand why God shows up at the end, and he doesn't really answer Job's questions, but he says, here's my wonderful servant Job, Job's just been like, I hate you, God. Why has this happened? Come here and answer me right now. And he goes, and then there are these three jokers over here who I'm not really crazy about them. And those are the three friends who've been arguing on God's side. They've been doing all the right things. And he said, I can't remember where he read this or heard this, but he said the thing that finally brought that into focus was Job was at least talking to God as if he were there. He was waiting for an answer. He was expressing himself. he had a personal relationship of some sort, whereas these three were talking about God as if he was a thing.
Right. So do you want to go to heaven, or do you want to go to a lecture about heaven?
Right. And that's, he said, yeah. He said, it's as if I were giving a lecture and two students stood up and started arguing about what I was saying, but never let me talk.
Yeah.
Just saying, well, Dr. Kraft is right. Dr. Kraft is wrong. He's like, hello, right here. And that kind of that thing you're saying about that despair is, I imagine over various things, you know, you lose your faith, you come back to it, you experience despair over some things because we're all human and these are feelings you can't get around. But how do you deal with those feelings?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
this lady at the – didn't the lady who Beth went to meet – her daughter's murderer had never been brought to trial through a snafu that
D.I. Yep, right.
Hardy had been involved with.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't she kind of blaming it on the fact that she never got that closure?
Yeah.
And you look at it and you go, but you know, whether you get that closure or not, your daughter's still dead. You have to live with your life. What is your life worth with or without your daughter? And that makes me sound super self-righteous. Keep in mind, I'm talking about a fictional character and not anybody's had something horrible happen. But at least you have someone to shout at and wait for them to answer if you're religious.
Yeah. Well, true. You know? Yeah. Yeah. It's just a thought that I had. You know, I know that, that a lot of the times when I have a kind of a broader perspective, excuse me. So when I have a broader perspective, the little things in life mean less.
Yeah.
Or the nagging things, you know.
Yeah.
You're like, well, this is just you know, temporary state of whatever. But you know, it's not like I think that. It's just that it is. You know, it's it's less important.
It's part of your worldview.
Right.
Your and Lent is which we're in right now. Lent is a good time to think about all that, because that's part of what taking extra things on, giving extra things up is supposed to help us do, is see more clearly.
Yeah.
See God and talk to him more clearly, understand who we are and where we are, because all that helps you fight despair, although you wouldn't think so, but it really does. You discover you're not in control of a lot of stuff, and it's kind of, that's okay, actually.
Yeah, isn't it a Buddhist thing? Yeah, it's something that we share a little bit with Buddhism with, that, you know, Buddhism wants you to let go of all of that stuff, pretty much let go of the world practically. It's almost as if you're not affected by anything.
Oh, well,
anything worldly, you know what I mean?
They take it too far.
Yeah,
but yes.
It's the same thing, but farther. It reminds me of something that Father James Martin talked about. He was talking about freedom of thought, really, that Pope Francis has.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a freedom of unattachment.
Yeah.
And that's just something that you have. And if you have that freedom of not being attached, that allows you to do a lot of other things. And it allows you to live in a more full way. And I think that's what, as Catholics, we're called to do, and it is really difficult. You know, once you have a child, you are permanently attached, you know, right? You know, there's just this, you know, we all have attachments to things and people.
And it's not
that Pope Francis does not have that, but I'm just saying, you know, the freedom of thought is what I think Father Martin was talking about.
Well, and when you talk about children, that's and spouses and friends. And the thing is that I guess maybe what makes us different than the Buddhists, and I know very little about Buddhism except that what you said sounds absolutely right to me.
Mm.
But from the Catholic point of view, what we're supposed to have is a proper perspective. These people are all important to us, and we can certainly love them and be attached to them, but we have to understand they're not God. We're not in control of them. I mean, you know, it's that balancing act always of where do we all fit in things? And so how do you deal with that?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does. It sure does.
Yeah. And so this lady has a total lack of perspective.
Yeah, she's had her perspective crushed.
That's kind of what you're saying, I guess, is she's got no sense of perspective.
Exactly at all, right.
Because everything is wrapped up in... I know, I was listening to her going, wow, you need a different counselor.
It's extremely tragic. It's not like I don't feel for her.
Yeah.
But I can totally understand, you know, in lesser ways, we are all pulled away from that and towards despair through all kinds of different things. Mm-hmm. And it's just a reminder. You know, she was at the extreme. We were all on that same line, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
You know. Yeah, because it's when you give yourself permission to go down that road, which is what happened with Joe.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
He kind of slid into it, but he's an adult. He knew there was probably many points where he could have stopped and pulled back, and he didn't. Just like this lady, yes, it is tragic, but there have to be moments of even just flashes of self-awareness every so often, where even if your self-awareness is only, I need to get help, this isn't right.
Right, right.
You know, I can't do it and I can't even think, but I do know something's not right. But then you have to admit you're not perfect. You have to admit, I mean, you know,
that we all had the grace to do that.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
It
comes back to humility, which is, you know, that sense of perspective.
Right. It's tough to see that in ourselves.
Right.
It's like, you know, and there's a lot of justification, self-justification. It's tough to let go of things. I mean, all this stuff is absolutely true, but that's where God can help.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I did like a lot of things about what the vicar did in this. And I really applaud how he was written and how he was played. And I actually kind of love that the part was written for that particular actor, and that he, especially having seen him as Rory on Doctor Who with David Tennant.
That's too funny. I didn't know that. Yeah, apparently this, I don't know. I'm not Doctor Who educated.
No, it was with the next Doctor. Sorry.
Is it? Okay, cool.
It was with
this,
the doctor.
The writer of this wrote some Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's neat that he did write it for this guy, because in that making of thing that I saw, and it's on YouTube, I'll link to it in the show notes. But they were talking to him, and he actually went and hung out with a 32-year-old vicar for a while.
Oh, neat.
So just in preparation. You know, he was learning, you know, what this guy's life was really like, and that was neat.
That is.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and I liked a lot of the things, like when Beth and her husband go to the vicar. Is it about when she's trying to decide if she should keep the baby or not?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I was just sitting there just getting ready to cringe. And his counsel actually was when he said, doesn't he say at one point, maybe this baby is sent to help you have new life or something?
Yeah, he said, if I remember right, it was something along the order of, maybe God has sent you not what you want, but what you need.
Yes. And I thought, bingo.
Yeah.
We don't always know what we need, which is most of the people in this town.
Yeah.
Obviously have problems knowing what they need. And it's so hard to not just let yourself do what you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't remember. Mark.
Uh-huh.
Beth's
husband.
Mark,
okay.
Who has the affair with the lady who runs the hotel. You know, and he's willing. He's like, I'll do it some more. Let's do it some more. And she's like, are you kidding me? No, says the lady who runs the hotel.
Right, right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And, but what it made me think, all this stuff, thinking over it, this town, it's like going to one of these Christ Renews His Parish retreats that our parish has a couple times a year. Because what happens is after you give the retreat, you meet once a week for 6 months or so, and then you're the ones who put on the next retreat. Well, while you're doing this, you're sharing your stories with each other. It's part of how you discern what role you'll play in the next retreat. It's how you get to be really good friends and all this kind of thing. And whether the stuff is big or small, what you really discover is we've all got stuff. Everybody you look at who, oh, they've got money, they don't have my problems, their lives must be nice. Oh, look, they've got a loving family, their life isn't like mine, theirs must be nice. Everybody's wanting something that these other people look perfect at, and no one's life is perfect. Everyone is struggling with some demon,
yeah,
for lack of a better term. And it's something that it's easy to forget, especially I did it, gosh, in 2003, so a long time ago. And something like this reminds you that that's just the human condition. And that's the other reason why acknowledging a higher power, that God is a real person who cares intimately about you, makes a huge difference. Because you can't try to be like other people, but it's not going to help. We've all got stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the lures or the draws of Christianity to me, is that its view of human nature seems real.
Yes.
You know, and I don't see that everywhere else. It's just one of the things about Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway,
I agree.
I'll leave that there. That's how I feel anyway.
Well said, sir.
Thank you. Trying to think of what else to say about this show. Maybe the interconnectedness of everything in a small town. You know, small towns are funny because they can be good or bad, right? Did you live in a small town? I can't remember.
No.
You never my really parents, have?
When we lived in a small town, we actually lived on the outskirts and didn't associate with them much because our parents kept saying that we were better than them. So
we
didn't have a good model for small town living.
Gotcha.
We didn't really rub shoulders except at school.
Yeah. Well, in a small town, I think that I think it's a really good experience if you're in the group, and probably a pretty negative experience if you're not in the group.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I lived in a small town in Idaho for a long time, and I felt like I was in the group. I had a very positive experience, even though I wasn't a member of the predominant religion or anything like that. I always felt welcomed and everything like that. So I had a really positive experience. But I could easily see that there were people that really weren't part of the in-group that were having a very difficult time being in a small town. I think that shows here. And everything's interconnected. Everybody knows your business.
Boy, do they. Well, you know,
and it's good and bad, both.
Do they know it? Because in this small town representation, everybody thinks they know about everybody else.
That's absolutely true.
Is the minute the surface gets scratched, you're finding about this lady the cocaine and this guy who's doing this other stuff.
I was on the school board for a while, and there are rules that, if you break these rules, you could face prosecution. And a lot of the rules have to do with personnel. And if you have like a executive committee meeting about personnel, you are not allowed to talk about what happened in that executive committee meeting.
Oh, yeah.
Period, right? So you'd come out of there, and the prevailing opinion in this small town was X, and you know that what happened was Y.
Oh, and that's hard.
You are not allowed to do anything about it. And so you're absolutely right. There's a lot of, they think that they know what's going on, and often that they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's tough. On the good side, when you have small children, if a stranger's in town, everybody knows.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, your kids are riding bikes on the streets and all this stuff and running down the road. And then someone shows up in town that doesn't belong, and everybody's eyes are on that person.
Hmm.
You know, again, good and bad. If that person, is moving to town, that's something. If he's prowling around town, that person will have a cop behind him in no time. You know, very safe.
Yeah. Well, and of course, in Broadchurch, they had a different problem because they were a resort town. And although it wasn't open season for the resort, they would have a lot of people coming and going that they wouldn't expect, I guess. But I was thinking, and I guess in that way, they're like the prime example of what we face in all these different little communities that we're parts of. It's just easier for us to go off and go, well, this community rejected me. I'm in a big town, or I'm on the internet, or whatever it is, I'll go find a different community that will accept me. as opposed to a small town where you don't have those resources, maybe.
Right. And there was a lot of really good things about the small town that I loved, you know, just, you know, impromptu barbecues would happen every now and then, you know, you have 20 people together all of a sudden. Some of those things were just a lot of fun.
That sounds great.
Yeah, exactly. And, so yeah, so, you know, good and bad, but, But you know, if you want to look at, you know, a microcosm of how interconnected we all are, you know, this is a really good example. You know, it is in a small town, but everybody's connected. You know, in some way or another, there's something going on that's pushing or pulling between every two people that there is. And I think, you know, as a planet, you know, we're getting more and more that way, that we're all kind of interconnected in some way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things going on in another continent affect us, and well, that's getting more and more common.
Yeah, and we don't. It's also a good look at the fact that a lot of times the things we do cause ripples in places you don't expect.
True. Yeah.
And what you said about the planet made me think about the Catholic concept that my sin affects everyone. You know, I guess it's like secondhand smoke or something. I'm trying to think of a good analogy for it, but it doesn't just bother me and the people I'm directly in contact with who I might have, I don't know, sinned against somehow. If I've lied to someone or I've taken something from them or whatever it is I've done, or I slammed the door in somebody's face so they got mad and turned around and yelled at someone else or whatever. It's this idea of, on some mystic level that we can't see, it touches everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the good news is that the good things we do also help everyone, too.
That's right. Prayer is an example.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, a lot of people think that that's worthless. It's a waste of time.
But no.
I can attest that it is not.
Me too, but do you have a specific example you're thinking of?
No, nothing specific that I can share at the moment. But but it's just, you know, I can attest that that's so.
Yeah, and this also isn't something I want to share, but it's funny how you can pray about something and something else pops up and you're like, oh my gosh, I think that's an answer to my prayer. It might not be, but you're going, this
sometimes God gives you what you need, not what you want.
And that's what happens is it comes around, like, you know, full circle, and you suddenly go, oh, wait a minute, this is connected to that thing over there. Oh, I never guessed.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And it all worked out for good.
It is something that's neat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So cool. So we've kind of gone around this thing, but I think it's so worth watching. It's a really terrific show. There's not a heck of a lot of religious stuff in it, you know, and it touched me that way. You know, most novels do. That's just the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're talking about deep human things, it's touching the chord that to me is a religious chord. So.
Well. Isn't that what our podcast is talking about all the time anyway?
That is absolutely right.
And so that's why it's perfect. And it did hit those chords, and that's why I was really surprised actually to see religion highlighted as much as it was. But that's why it grabbed my husband and me enough that we would talk about it and talk about the real humanity that we saw in these characters.
Oh, and it is heart-wrenching. Oh, my gosh.
Oh yeah,
the first and the last episodes.
Oh well,
I wept. I have to admit that I wept in both cases.
That woman's the mother Beth's horror as you're watching this unfold, and you know the premise: somebody dies, and you're watching her as she's like, "Oh, he forgot to take his lunch. Oh, well, I'll just take it to the field day or whatever." Yeah. Oh, you haven't seen him, huh, honey? Answer your phone. Oh. And then you're watching it escalate and escalate, and this is every parent's worst nightmare.
Yeah, and that's just something that they can do in television that they can't even do in movies, because mm-hmm. the movies, there's just not enough time.
Right.
You know, for that to take 15 minutes in a television show, for that escalation to happen, I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's an eighth of a movie already. But it was so good.
Well, and the family sitting around afterward dealing with the fact that they couldn't even have a funeral because their son's body was evidence, mm-hmm. and the father saying, can I go see him? Because maybe you made a mistake. It's all the things that we ourselves would have to deal with, you know, and him going, I'm sorry that this happened. I let you down. I didn't protect you, because that's what any father would feel.
Oh, and I just loved Ellie. You know? I mean, during that moment, too, Ellie sitting there as a friend of the family. She knows these people personally. Her son is a friend of this kid who died. And this guy says, you could be wrong. I need to see him. And she does not react with a lick of anger. She's like, let's go. Let's go. I'll take you there. Yeah. And I just loved her. I just loved her to death. And poor her at the end. Gosh. Oh man.
Oh, that was just brutal.
Oh, that was tough. But man.
And having to be in the hotel room with the kids.
Oh, boy.
And was it her sister and somebody else came over, you know, to be in the hotel room with them. So they were just kind of out of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Man, your own house is a crime scene.
Yep.
Yep.
And you're the police, and you didn't see it. You didn't see anything of it. She slept next to this guy, and he did what he did. And she's like some inspector.
Yeah.
So it I mean, every piece of her being was affected. There wasn't anything left.
Yeah, it hit her on every single level. Mother, wife, job.
Absolutely.
Everything that was her identity.
Yeah.
And that's why it was so great that David Tennant had been so betrayed by his wife. In a different way altogether.
Oh, yeah. You know, there was something else that had happened in the last one. There's at the beginning of the thing, you know, he knows who did it. He's figured it out, and he's just verifying it. And he's got to verify it without her, because he doesn't want her interference.
Yeah.
And he wants to protect her, too, which is something. They've been at odds this whole time, and he really cares for her.
Yeah.
And he doesn't, you know, he wishes that this wasn't happening. So he actually said, my mom said God will put you in the right place, even if you don't know it at the time. And he was at the place because she wouldn't have been able to do what needed to be done at that time.
Mm.
You know?
That's why she didn't get the job. I never connected that.
Yeah. And that was just in the last episode.
Wow. I didn't connect that.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was cool. I mean, yeah, and then their relationship was something at the end, too. He was the only one she had at the end. That was it. There was no more. So, and he accepted her. He stopped his snide manner throughout the whole thing and opened up at the end to her because he was all she had.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really neat, too.
Yeah, it was. And it was also nice to see him acting a part that was serious. I mean, I know he's done Hamlet, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
And various other things. But all I'd seen him in was Doctor Who, which I don't know if you've seen it with him
no,
in it.
No, was he the first Doctor Who in the new?
The second one.
The second one of the new generation. Okay, so I have
and
not. I haven't
he
seen
was,
it.
He was so good. He was obviously, you watch it, the first two are my favorite. What, somebody, Eccleston, I think is the guy's name. Anyway, and him. But he, unfortunately, they kind of got into this storyline toward the end of him being there, which was, I was like, I don't know. No, lovelorn Doctor Who, stop moping around and be your old happy self again. I don't care about that stuff. But he was pretty amazing. But Doctor Who is, you know, lighthearted and fantastical and all these other things. So it was interesting to see him playing something that was completely gruff and different.
Yeah.
And he did it really, really well.
It'll be interesting to see if his health gets fixed. You know, because he's really, he's having heart palpitations and stuff, really very possibly from, it's not like his, he's got some disease. It's just that he is so racked with guilt constantly
and stress.
That it's just affecting his body.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen the first episode of season two, though. So.
Well, and they also, but I also liked the way that they dealt with the media and the way the media's responsibility in a case like this.
That was something.
What does it mean to be part of the community, and how do you make the decisions about what do you cover and what don't you cover?
Yeah.
You know, just stuff like that. I liked that whole thing, too, because everybody there has to keep doing their jobs. It wasn't just Ellie investigating people she liked, where she kept going, well, no, they just wouldn't do it. He's like, you've got to stop thinking that way. And by the end, he's saying, well, what are you thinking? She's like, I don't know. And he goes, now you're progressing.
Yeah.
That's better.
That was better.
Yeah.
And I love their repertoire, or whatever you call it.
Repartee,
yeah. The vicar, there was a conversation between Tennant and the vicar, and she was there. And he was basically accusing the vicar of doing it. And the vicar says to her, is he always like this? And she said, no, he's having a particularly good day. And she's like looking at her shoes. She's just so embarrassed. But she's just like, you know, maybe it's true. I don't know if it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, wow. Well, good. Anyway, I'm glad you liked it. But you saw it... you saw it before I even picked it, so.
Oh, yeah.
So you didn't watch it on my behalf, but I'm glad that you liked it. Because I was like, I'm picking this. I got to pick it.
If I'd have had time, I would have watched it again, but I just didn't. So I had to go with what I remembered of the things that we thought at the time.
What service did you watch it on? What do you like to use?
I think we watched it on Netflix because we are... This is the role reversal. Rose has Netflix. We're part of her Netflix family.
I see.
Okay. So we watched it on her Netflix.
So I wonder when it'll show up there. Maybe after it runs on BBC America.
Yeah, that's what I figured once it was done. BBC America's
I forked over $2 for episode one on iTunes.
You sucker.
I had to see what was going to happen. It was like, you know...
But doesn't that one little taste of candy just make you want the whole bar?
It really does. It really does. You know, and there's something about these British shows, too. I love Sherlock.
Mm-hmm.
I love Luther. Heather Ordover, when she was on this podcast, mentioned Luther. And I love that show.
I didn't watch that.
Yeah, it is intense, but man, good show.
When you were talking about this, it made me think about Prime Suspect with Helen Mirren. Did you ever see that?
I did not,
Talk about intense. Oh, man. I'm not sure how many seasons of Prime Suspect they had, but we started watching about the beginning, and it was good. It was, you know, she was fighting for recognition as a detective, and all the crimes were gruesome and horrible, but she would solve them while, you know, trying to prove herself. And she was just hard as nails. And eventually the crimes got so gruesome as they went along that I just went, no, and I'm tired of seeing you struggle for recognition again. So it was that they can do that American thing too.
Yeah.
But the British shows seem to have an attention to detail, or maybe it's just the ones that make it over here. Like the ones American shows that make it over there. Because they have a lot of shows that
I always just wonder if it's just how they do stuff, because, you know, Broadchurch, they made 8 episodes. You know, it wasn't like it was canceled after 8 episodes. That was the design. That was what they made. You know, that was what was ordered. They made it. They showed it. People liked it, you know, and then they get renewed, and it's like 2 years later, they do another 8. You know, and I just think that that's a lot better than what we do.
I don't know if I agree with that.
Okay.
I am an American. More is more.
More is more. It's like, don't you think we seem to run these things into the ground? I mean, if it's a hit show, it just goes and goes and goes until it jumps the shark and dies.
But is that terrible? I mean, I got 5 great seasons of House. I got a lot of good seasons of House that they might not have done in Britain. And I got 22 episodes in every single season, everybody.
that's true.
I get Bob's Burgers. No, they've had a lot of half seasons of that.
Yeah,
when I get Bob's Burgers and it's a full season, I'm getting 22 episodes of comedy that, as my husband said, he goes, how can they come so close to that line of gross distastefulness, but yet stopped just in time to be hilarious. I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I like to see that 22 times a year instead of 8.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm not saying it's bad or good.
I can't say I disagree. You know, I watch them too. I actually don't follow a lot of shows.
No.
But to have a beginning, middle, and an end, you know, in an 8 episode arc is pretty satisfying. It's like, Battlestar Galactica is one of my favorite shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it ran 5 seasons. And it was like season 1 was great, season 2 is great, and then 3 it was like a faltering, and then 4 was like completely lost direction, and then they said, okay, we're going to do one last season. And then all of a sudden, boom, it had focus and was great.
Pulled it together.
Yeah.
But so, wasn't that cable? Wasn't it like 10 or 12 per season? Or was it
something like that? I don't think it was 22.
No, I think it was. Yeah.
Well, it was on Sci-Fi Channel, right?
Because what you're talking about is the miniseries concept.
I think Battlestar Galactica. Cable. Yeah, Battlestar Galactica was really a series, though. I don't know. It may not have done the full 22 episodes each season. I don't even recall.
Because it was, I'm pretty sure it was cable.
Yeah, it was cable. It was cable.
Yeah, so they don't have as long seasons. But what I was saying is that you saying, you know, beginning, middle, end, that's kind of the miniseries arc.
Mm-hmm.
6, 8 shows.
Yeah, I do like those. Most of the ones I saw were Stephen King related, though.
Oh, well, I remember Roots.
Yeah.
And
Shogun.
Shogun, and the classics.
Now, there's a big book that I liked.
That I also liked that book quite a lot, Shogun. And we could read that again. It would only be my 4th or 5th time.
Excellent.
But yeah, I don't know that there's anything. I guess what I'm saying is, I don't think we could just say British TV is better because their seasons are shorter. Because I think there's a lot of stuff like Benny Hill out there that we're just not seeing.
Okay.
But I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Sure. Yeah.
Speak up, somebody. Tell us.
Yeah.
Is it all amazing? And we're just being held out on?
Yeah. It may be that we're just getting the very best of that. But I'm noticing on Netflix, there's a lot of shows. There was one I started to take a look at that. The name escapes me, of course. It was just on the very edge of consciousness. Let me see if I can.
That's all right.
But it was another cop show. Cops and doctors.
Of course.
Is that what most shows are about? Cops and doctors.
Yeah.
Hinterland. Cops, that's
lawyers,
what it's called. Hinterland is the name of the show, and it takes place in Wales.
Oh, okay. I was going to say somewhere far away. Wales is close. That Wales is good.
Wales is good, yeah.
That's with Doctor Who. That's why Tom's always laughing when something will happen and there's like, they're not really in London. They're in some part of Wales. And that's why, because it's a Welsh TV company that does it.
I had to put on the subtitles for Hinterland. Because they would say Welsh words every now and then, place names. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
So you see it's spelled, and of course they don't say it anything like it's spelled. At least it doesn't make any sense to me anyway. But
what is it with those languages? That's like when I was doing some chapters of a book where somebody was traveling through Denmark on Forgotten Classics, and I was having to look up how to say these names and listen to Forvo as people would pronounce them. And I'm like, there are none of the things you're saying have any letters in common with this word I'm looking at. What are you talking about?
Too many consonants.
Yeah, and like sounds. You know, stop it.
Oh, man.
Clean it up, people, or come up with some new letters or something.
I love it. That.
Well, I guess we've strayed pretty far from the point now. No, but I'm glad you chose it. I had not thought about it since then, but it really was so good, and we talked about it for a long time afterward, like I said.
Yeah, cool.
It was really worth watching.
Yep. Excellent. All right. So what's coming up next? Foundation by Isaac Asimov.
Ooh,
a little bit of classic science fiction.
Yes. I just picked that up from the library today.
Excellent.
I opened it up, looked at the first page, and went, I don't even recognize this. Wonderful. It's like it's brand new.
Oh, I love it. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So cool. I look forward to talking about that. That's an all-time favorite. So, and then Shall We Dance, a Japanese movie.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Very cool. And then Valley of Bones by Michael Gruber.
Speaking of mystery.
Yeah, it's sitting comfortably on my Kindle right now.
Ah, managing to fit on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to mention to anybody who's listening and might need a long time for a long book, sometime late summer, I'm going to pick Uncle Tom's Cabin.
All right.
So I guess I should put that in the sidebar. I don't know if anybody but you or me looks at the sidebar.
The wonderful sidebar.
Yes. In the coming attractions for, I think it's sometime in August or sometime, but
yeah. Okay.
That it would come up. But
fantastic.
Yeah. So
very good. Very good. All right. Well, thanks for another episode.
Oh.
And thanks for listening, everyone.
Yes. Thank you, everyone. And we'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.